So this morning I'm going to talk about fulfilling the Buddha way, our little excerpt from the Lotus Sutra that's part of our new sutra book. And we read it just now in our sutra service. It's an interesting excerpt in many ways from a much larger set of teachings that are called the Lotus Sutra. The Lotus Sutra, just to say a little bit about that, is a so-called Mahayana Sutra. It was probably composed maybe 100 years BC or 100 years AD, somewhere in that 200-year period it appeared in Sanskrit and was translated into Chinese and all the other East Asian languages of the Mahayana tradition. And it's possibly the first sutra in the Buddhist tradition that mentions the word Mahayana, which means great vehicle and of which Zen is a part. It was a very important text in the Tendai school, which is an esoteric school of Buddhism, that many Zen teachers in China and Japan trained in before moving on to Zen, although some of them didn't really move on to Zen. They were more Tendai teachers who called themselves Zen teachers or had received transmission from a Zen teacher. And one of those teachers was Dogen, and this is another reason why this sutra is so important to us, because Dogen quoted it extensively throughout his own writings, and he had studied Tendai Buddhism as a young man before he encountered Zen, and especially, of course, before he encountered the Zen of his heart teacher in China, which he brought back to Japan with him. So it's an interesting text in many ways, and the legend that spoken about, and this is true of all the Mahayana sutras in general in some way or other, and also some of the Tibetan teachings, that they were hidden. They were actually spoken by the Buddha during his lifetime, but then they were hidden because people thought, and who knows, maybe the Buddha himself thought, or his disciples or followers thought, that people of that time weren't ready to hear it. That's how the people who composed the Mahayana Sutras got around the fact that they didn't appear for hundreds of years. And the particular story that's told about the Lotus Sutra is that whoever that was who decided that people of that day, of Shakyamuni Buddha's day, weren't ready for it, took it to the realm of the snake gods and hid it there for 500 years. And then it appeared in the world when people were ready to hear it. So clearly, even there, we're not talking about literal truth. And the Lotus Sutra is full of stories and allusions to this kind of magical, mystical part of Buddhism, which we don't talk about that much in Zen, certainly not in Boundless Way Zen. But personally, I love that part of Zen. There are esoteric teachings involved in the transmission of the Dharma from teacher to teacher. There are ways of encountering this practice through dreams and poetry and metaphors. The dreamlike quality of the Sambhogakaya, the bliss body of the Buddha, or the affirmation body of the Buddha, the appreciation body of the Buddha. Usually we hear about the other two bodies of the Buddha, the Dharmakaya, the body of oneness and thusness, and the absolute Shunyata body, and then the Nirmanakaya body, which is the activity body, which is represented by Shakyamuni Buddha himself. In Mahayana teachings, he was the one who came to the earth, touched the ground, was embodied, and we say ourselves that the great Buddha way must be embodied by us, and so we embody it in our sitting practice, in our walking, in our presence in everything we do, this Nirmanakaya, this activity body. But the Sambhogakaya is a little more squirrely It's so fantastic, and the Mahayana teachings and this teaching of the Lotus Sutra create or describe a world that is not like our ordinary world, not like the ordinary world where the past is in the past and the present is happening now and maybe the future will happen someday. It's not the world where the Buddha died 2,600 years ago. It's not the world where history unfolds and ordinary reality is appreciated. It posits a teaching where the Buddha never died because he couldn't die, because Buddha nature, this awakened nature, is everywhere. And because he was the awakened one, he wasn't the only one who was awake. There are countless Buddhas everywhere that surround us in fields of Buddhas. The Mahayana Sutras talk about this. Fields and fields of Buddhas, past, present, future, time and space collapse into this vast moment, this moment that we can appreciate. The appreciation body, the Sambhogakaya, can appreciate this, can really sink into it. We sometimes taste a little of this, even if we're very rational human beings, and I know that some of us are very rational and, in fact, in love with our rationality. Not a problem. It's good to have rational people. I'm happy for your support, since I'm not always that rational. And this rational way of orienting towards the world, this way of appreciating the song of the birds, thinking that spring is coming because it's getting lighter, and goodness knows what's going through their little tiny brains because it's so cold, but they're appreciating, somehow they're responding, they're aligning with, they're completely one with their bird nature, which only knows to sing when the light returns. We can appreciate this. We can appreciate the sunlight on the floor of the zendo, the way that every single day so far the sun has risen and brought light to the part of the planet where we're sitting, and then every night it sets again and then comes back, and it goes away and it comes back. And this is kind of, if you can get into this from this appreciation body perspective, the only thing that you could possibly say is, wow, bird song in the cold, cold, cold of late February. Wow, the light of the sun, the returning sun every day in here in the Zendo. Wow. Nat Needle, some of you know him, he's a beloved member of our Sangha, and he many years ago wrote a bunch of songs that teach different Dharma lessons, and he printed up copies of it. It's actually available for sale, and sometimes we sing them here, not as much as we used to. We used to do them for the children's service. When our daughter was very young, Nat gave us a cassette tape of some of his Buddhist songs, and we would play them in the car on trips and sing along with them. So our daughter, who does not consider herself a Zen Buddhist per se, knows all these Zen songs, sings them. And there's a lovely one which teaches the practice of bowing. And the chorus goes, it actually says, the first time I see somebody or other, let's say Stephen, the first time I see Stephen, inside I say, wow. And then when I look at Stephen again, then I say out loud, wow. And then the third time I look at Stephen, all I can do is bow. So he says, the chorus goes, doggies, they go bow, wow, wow, and people should go wow, wow, bow. So, and then he says, bow, wow, wow, and all the kids shout, wow, wow, bow. It's kind of like the appreciation body in song. It's kind of amazing. You look first, get a little hit, sunlight, and you look again, wow, and then all you can do is just succumb to the gratitude of of the particularity of this universe, the particularity that is part of the Dharmakaya as well as the Sambhogakaya, the magical quality, the wondering quality of what it means to be a human being who has perceiving apparatus. It's so amazing, really, that we can do this, that we can see and hear and smell and taste and touch and encounter each other, encounter these great mysteries that we call other human beings. So the Lotus Sutra is a wow-wow bow sutra. It's just over and over and over again telling us about the Buddha fields and how amazing this is, and everywhere that you encounter it. And in this excerpt, which is so important, I think, for our school, it says that you don't have to have some kind of huge experience of this to experience it. You don't have to have a big awakening experience. You can just have a little, oh, wow, experience, a little tiny one, maybe minuscule. My belief, and I know this is also James Ford's belief, and I think it's David's belief, is that everyone has these moments. They just continually occur. There's no way to avoid them. They arise, and because we're looking for something else, we don't recognize them, and then they fade away again. And then they arise, and then they fade away. And as James says in his book, if you're lucky, your heart will break. That is, you will break open to this wondrous nature, these Buddha fields, these constant reminders of the awakened nature that surrounds us. And these metaphors might not work for you, but I'm pretty convinced that everybody here has had one of those little tastes, little tip of the tongue openings, we call them sometimes. Hakuin, the 17th century Japanese Zen master, used to call them the little moments that make you dance. And we can experience this in shikantaza, we can experience this in breath practice, we can experience this through koan practice, we can experience it through cutting vegetables in the kitchen and through waking up in the morning in the cold and dark. We can experience this at any moment. We don't make it happen. We just set up conditions for it to be realized, to be uncovered. The great truth of the Mahayana is that everything is already Buddha. There is no place that isn't Buddha. When you say, that's not it, when the mind makes its divisions and tries to cut pieces of itself off, that is a mistaken view, a distorted view. And even the mistaken and distorted view is part of this great unfolding Buddha field that we are inextricably a part of. And in the text itself, the Buddha, this is supposedly the Buddha speaking, or somebody or other who wrote this 500 years after the Buddha died, he talks about all the different ways we can worship. And I find this very important because Zen, sometimes some people say Zen is not religious. But in my view anyway, and I think some of the other teachers agree with me, it's very religious. It's about forms and ritual and setting up conditions, as all religions are, for the awakened heart to be realized in whatever metaphoric shape it gets realized. So in Christianity, it gets realized one way, and in Islam, Judaism, Sufism, they all find some way to set us up to encounter this thing that can't be named, and yet we give it names. We give it metaphoric stories. We talk about snake realms and Buddha fields. These are just ways of talking about it, and the Lotus Sutra is full of them. So everything we do, everything we encounter, if we play music and present these as offerings, if we go to do the usual things, which are going to stupas and mausoleums and jeweled and painted images, flowers, incense, etc. Even if we sing a song, like one of Nat's songs, the Wow Wow Bow song, or any of our sutras, even with just a tiny sound, this text says, then we've fulfilled the Buddha way. It doesn't matter how big or how little, just, you might say, some sort of little activity of the Buddha body cooperating with the universe, it's complete in itself. Even if we do it wrong, it's complete. There isn't any way in this kind of teaching for us to make mistakes, because the mistakes, too, are part of the awakened Buddha fields. A single flower, even while distracted, if anyone with even a single flower, even while distracted, that's really important. The distraction is part of it, too. Some of us work really, really hard to develop our concentration practices, which is a venerable part of all Buddhist teachings, including Zen. The focus on the breath, the deep focus on whatever is arising in this present moment. But we get distracted. It's normal. It's natural. And the Lotus Sutra says that the distractions are not a problem. You offer even a single flower, even while distracted, you will see countless Buddhas. It just, once you see them, you can't stop seeing them. Or whatever metaphor you like to use. This is the metaphor of the Lotus Sutra, so I'm going to continue using it. And then you can throw yourself down on the ground. You can do a gassho. You can just put one hand up. Or you can slightly nod your head. I love that line. Just a little slight nod of the head. And that's enough. That's enough to join this vastness, this Buddha field. Because, of course, you're already part of it. So everyone will see this. Everyone will fulfill the unexcelled way themselves. Now, the problem we run into here with this teaching is that you might be thinking, except for me. I have some proof that this wouldn't work for me because I'm really a miserable human being, and I can give you a long, long list of all the ways that I've failed and have been excluded somehow from this Buddha realm. And the thing about the Lotus Sutra teachings is that's irrelevant. It doesn't matter how much you have a negative opinion of yourself. It doesn't matter how much you make mistakes, and people tell you you've made mistakes. It doesn't matter, because you're still part of this great fabric of existence, and there's no way to get out of it, even if you struggle and struggle and struggle, because the struggle is also part of it. The trying to get out of it is part of it. The endless lists of inadequacies are part of it. Everything. It's not just all the good stuff, it's part of it. Everything. Your pain is part of it. Your bad luck is part of it. Everything is part of these Buddha fields. What an amazing teaching. There's no way out of it. You can try and try and try, but the trying itself reveals countless Buddha fields. This is just a very unusual and amazing teaching, hard for us in the 21st century here in America to grasp. So don't try to grasp it. Keep your hands open. It'll come to you. These are all the teachings about the awakened heart and the great vehicle. It will come to you. The realization will come to you. It will be uncovered. It will be revealed. It sounds pretty great, huh? And just watch that mind that says, no, couldn't be. Not for me. I don't believe it. The world is on fire with suffering. This couldn't be true. But the teaching of the Lotus Sutra is that all of this suffering is also it. So, what can you do once you realize this? Once the Buddha fields reveal themselves to you, and this little excerpt says, save countless beings everywhere. That's our great vow. We vow this twice a day here at Sesshin, and we vow it in our hearts, hopefully all throughout the day. The 10th grave precept that we take when we take Jukhai is to not spare the Dharma assets of Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, to always be giving ourselves in whatever way we can. And everyone in this room and everyone listening to this recording has their own way of expressing our own Buddha nature as ourselves. We don't have to become some other person, as that other text I read the other day says, some wooden puppet, or in the original translation, Zen robot. We don't have to be that person. We can be fully ourselves, just as we are. And that's how we save countless beings, because we are countless beings. Our first teacher, Richard Clark, his translation of the first Bodhisattva vow was, all beings, one body, I vow to liberate. Because we are one body. There's just one body. There's just this Buddha field that everything is occurring in. So then it's easy to liberate all beings. We're already liberated. We don't have to do it. We just have to see what liberation really is. It's almost never our idea of what liberation is, because our ideas are always limited. That's just the way ideas are. So even while distracted, anyone, even while distracted, when you enter a stupa or a mausoleum, a temple, any place where the Buddha way is being taught or practiced, and you even once exclaim, "Hail to the Buddha!" Maybe you don't make that a practice in your life. So instead of "Hail to the Buddha," you could just say, "Wow, wow, bow." Wow, wow, bow. That would be enough. Bowing is the expression of the recognition before thought of this field of endless Buddhas, this field of endless awakening, always unfolding, always present, not seen because we're always looking somewhere else. Sitting open, present, these things will be revealed to us. It's not a technique. It's simply a wearing away of all of our ideas. All of our ideas of what should be and what actually is. When it's all worn away, everything shines with its own light. This truth never fails. So, just a few words from the Lotus Sutra to end. If they joyfully praise the Buddha's virtues in song, even with just a tiny sound, they have fulfilled the Buddha way. If anyone, with even a single flower, even while distracted, makes an offering, they will gradually see countless Buddhas. There are those who worship by prostrating themselves, some merely by putting palms together, others by raising a single hand, others by a slight nod of the head. All of these people, honoring images in various ways, will progressively see countless Buddhas and fulfill the unexcelled way themselves. Save countless beings everywhere, as a fire dies out when the firewood is all consumed. Enter into nirvana without residue. If even while distracted, you enter a stupa or a mausoleum and you even once exclaim, "Wow, you have fulfilled the way." Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and this is when we make an offering of a word or a nod or something to our Dharma dialogue.
My first reaction when we were reading this earlier was a feeling of kind of rejection. Kind of based on the idea about, like, no, wait a minute, you know, it's not about going to a stupa. It's, you know, and then, but then starting to feel like, well, whatever it is, it's just another form of bowing. It's just... And then, and so then the question I'm left with is, does it have to be earnest? whatever it is. The form isn't important, but is the intention? I guess is my question.
Well, in this sutra, it says no.
That's what I thought. Yeah,
isn't that cool? Be half-hearted.
Usually in Zen, we say, you know, wholehearted.
Right,
you know, anything we do with 100% do, that is realizing our koan.
Yeah.
This is saying even half-hearted, even while distracted, to turn in that direction fulfills the Buddha way.
You feel like you're getting taken off the hook a little?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or and like cast adrift.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, I thought I knew. I thought I knew something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and this in the from one perspective, we want the fullness of life, and we know we don't have it, right? And so we work hard, and I think it's so important in our practice to realize how lacking we are, you know? And so important not to get stuck there.
Yeah.
And this is these lovely Buddha field, on Buddha field, that nothing but Buddhas everywhere, you know, and we go around looking for water. Where are those damn Buddha fields? I'm going to find my way to, you know. So it sort of counteracts that earnestness we can get, the wonderful earnestness, and does, because we get attached to, I am a seeker. I will enact the way. You know, and if we get stuck there, then that's our new identity. Yeah. Right, so this sort of undercuts that, you know, so what do you think you're doing? In the Buddha fields here. Oh, I'm working hard to find the Buddha fields. Well, that's a nice thing to do in the Buddha fields, to look for the Buddha fields.
Well, and you know, the teaching is there isn't anything lacking.
Right.
This view that we have that our life is dead and depressing and dull. We have to see dead, depressing, and dull, and even the feeling of lacking is
fulfilled.
Yeah. It's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jason and then Crystal.
I liked that in the beginning you mentioned the Sambhogakaya being part of the tradition that honors dreams and honors the unconscious. You used another word, dreams, and because one of the things that attracted me to Zen was the lack of magic. The lack of because I am a person who's requires, in order to devote myself to something, I require that I don't find holes in the intellectually, but there's a part of me that I think shows up in those moments where I do sense magic. Those moments you mentioned that is not at all intellectual. That loves, that feels that magic intensely, and that gives life to and color to everything, and so it's nice to hear that you know, sometimes Zen, I feel like, is, you know, everybody's wearing black and it's serious and there's always dark wood and everything is, but like, you know, there's all that color, you know. I like the discussion of the teachings that have the color of that you see, like in Tibet, but like, you know, there's something there.
Yeah, and thank you for saying that, Jason, because I think, you know, for me anyway, people naturally have tendencies towards one of those three bodies of the Buddha. You know, we really relate to it, the Dharma body. You know, we relate to thusness and emptiness, such a relief. Everything's so black and white and, you know, plain and nothing. We love nothing. And then some of us love the Nirmanakaya, you know, mindfulness practices and being really present to everything we do. And some of us love this magical, mystical realm. But just having one of those without the other two, it's not. I don't think that's a balanced practice. So, you know, I can think of people who have just one or some combination of two, but to open to all three. It's very important. So, yeah, we certainly emphasize Dharmakaya here and Nirmanakaya. But there's Sambhogakaya woven through it all. And how could it not be? It's just part of the whole deal. Yeah. Christine and then Susan.
Thank you so much. What I was feeling as I listened and when I read it was just waves and waves of unconditional love. And what I love about it is that there's nothing that can get us rejected. Nothing. Nada. And what I noticed happening for me is that it was opening my heart in this, away from this mind part that I can really get into, don't step on a crack, break your mother's back, you know, do this, do that. Boy, one of the things that I see, and there was new space this morning when I got up as a result of a talk yesterday about being so attached to one's inadequacy, because I certainly can. And I noticed, I did something yesterday, I've been so good on this new nutrition plan, and I went off it, and when I got up this morning, just the first thing to greet me was, you blew it yesterday, blah, 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 and the story. And I've had intellectual distance from it before, but the new tracks came because there was new space, which was, well, why don't you be attached to that jade nature? But it just arose, and it wasn't even thinking, and there was just all kinds of space that there wasn't before. So as I listened to you today, I just felt that same space of like, oh, I get to be here with my heart, not out of fear of punishment or this just a striving that has been such a part of my life that feels so hard. And it's so important. It is. It's what's got me here. It's what keeps me going. But there's a whole other part that needs to blossom that I felt blossoming in listening. So, thank you.
Thank you. And just one comment to when we practice, we can then notice what happens in our life. That we say again and again, you can't force it. You can't, all right, here's the trick. I'm going to do, right when I wake up, I'm going to do my first Zen trick. You know, and well, maybe sometimes that works. But the just noticing what arises, what comes up, and this possibility of the release. Oh, and then we just notice, wow. I didn't have to go all the way down the rabbit hole today. And what a blessing when we encounter that. So, thank you.
One of the things that first attracted me about Zen was the idea that it was okay not to know. And I read, and I can't remember where, and I can't remember who was being described. It was a teacher, and maybe it was the Buddha, but that some person who had been coming to hear this person talk came very angrily and said, "I'm not coming anymore. You're just a fraud, and you haven't told me anything about birth and death and what's going to happen to me and all my relatives and everything." And the speaker said, "Did I say I was going to tell you that?" And then other things, just saying, you know, there's a lot. You just cannot, when the right answer is, "I don't know." And I haven't met anybody that knows. And the people who've talked the most about they know are the ones that I'm trying to get away from. So could you say something about, is there any kind of crossing point or interface between the magic and just, I don't know. I mean, in another way, so much has happened in our lifetime where things have been discovered in the natural world that nobody had a clue. Nobody knew that. And it just seems to me that it can be more productive not to jump to the conclusion that you know how something is.
And you want us to say something better than what you just said?
I want the answer!
Yeah, your question is exactly the point. Well, you know, what occurs to me is you're saying, you said the whole thing, this not knowing is, you know, as one teacher says, it's the most intimate. Right? It's really at the heart of so much of this, and there's a mystery there, isn't there? And there is magic, you know. Whenever I'm on Skype with somebody, I have a little like, whoa, wow, you know, this is one of those wow things. How if we went, you know, in a time machine to 1915 and tried to tell people about Skype and cell phones, the internet, I mean, even 30 years ago, I don't think, if somebody told me this kind of stuff would be happening, you know, you're crazy. So there is this opening to possibility, I think, that Zen really does favor and teach. And that's very important. Yeah. And we can come up with all kinds of ideas and theories, but hopefully we won't cling to them too much because we're going to get more information that refutes them, that changes them, turns them upside down, about ourselves as well, not just about the physical world. Yeah. And you know, and I want to make sure that I say this, because I had that thought earlier when Jason was talking about the Sambhogakaya, that if the only thing we celebrate is the Sambhogakaya, that leads to a certain kind of hell that is not so useful, you know. And we know people like that. I mean, I have that same discomfort with, everything is so magical and mystical and beautiful and crystals and, you know, stuff. But it's an important. We shouldn't just throw it out with the bathwater. You know that it also has some usefulness for us, embedded in this clarity that there is no knowing, there's nothing. The thusness, shunyata, and that right here in this body, this is where we get to realize that those three different ways of seeing really blend beautifully and keep us balanced. In my view.
And I think it's so important that the not knowing includes knowing. That in this vast field of the mystery of where we're coming from and where we're going to, that there are moments of incredible clarity where we can know without a doubt, and no one could ever tell you different. And this arises and disintegrates in the field of not knowing. The great boundless heart. Everything arises, appears and disappears. So room for all of it. Yeah. Thank you.
Some years back, I was, not too long ago, but I was reading, or was kind of following this online forum on Buddhism, and somebody posted something that was just ridiculing the Lotus Sutra and its followers. And, I didn't know anything about it, so I had no idea what the problem was, and couldn't quite follow the conversation, because I could never understand, well, what was this original person's problem? I didn't know what the deal was, but it must have been the magical quality that this person found so offensive. But I just wonder what it is about that aspect that gets even those of us who are given to rationalities just so exercised over it, you know, that we can't... and we feel like we've got to kind of destroy it. You know, it has no place in this world, and no value. And I don't know. It's just curious to me. It's almost like a little bit of autism or something that we can't connect to that at all, or not having a particular sense that some people have. That's interesting to me.
For some reason, I think of the... I've just done a little bit of work with a Native American teacher, and that when you do the ritual in the sacred circle, when you walk in the circle, you say, all my relations, and think of so many traditions that live in a world that's so animated with the Sambhogakaya. And I think our culture marginalizes and actually is even afraid. I think you point to something. It's not that it's okay for people to have, but wow, you're crazy if you think the trees are saying something. And how particular and peculiar our culture is. There have been so many cultures that honor a fullness that seems hard in some way, that doesn't fit into our language of the scientific revolution.
And I think people who are proponents of I'm going to call them the Sambhogakaya only school, can be very gushy, and there's no place to enter that view. And that's why I think it needs to be balanced, because it can really be offensive to people. I've been offended by it. I've seen, that happen. What came up for me, that there's an anthropologist named Angeles Arian, who studied South American shamans and Kirindo. Actually, she's gone all over the world studying various aspects of human culture, and she met a shaman somewhere in South America who diagnosed depression by asking four questions. The first question is, when in your life did you stop singing? When in your life did you stop dancing? When in your life did you stop being enchanted by stories? And when in your life did you stop listening to the sweet silence? I think that's what's missing. You know, when I hear those four things, I think, oh, right. So much of our culture has drifted away from that. So we have to be, I think that's one reason we chant in Zen. That's one reason why we bow. That's one reason we put flowers on the altar and light candles. And it's all part of this, our inheritance.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff I don't get, but but what's the harm in it?
Well, you know, there you go.
And some of it's just kind of fun. Why not?
Well, and there's a kind of trusting. Once you start to trust this ritual stuff, I don't get it. It doesn't make any sense to me, but I'll just do it. And then at some point, it does reveal itself. You know, that you're bowing, and you go, oh, oh, bowing. Yeah. With everything, I think, is like that.
Excuse me. Can I say one more thing? There's also the special case of people whose understanding is at a different level from yours. They're a little child, they're developmentally disabled, they've gotten too old and are over the hill. And how can you say they don't qualify?
Right.
You know,
a different language.
And so it is. It's like speaking a different language.
Yeah.
And you certainly wouldn't want to give yourself to a system in which those people didn't count.
Right. Right. That's right. So there's room for them. Yeah. There's room for this ritual.
Mm.
Yeah.
Just to take off on what you were saying, is Dave?
Susan.
Susan. Sorry. For me, it feels like every one of these pointers can shift your thinking, not thinking, but your perspective of the way things are, if you're open to them. For when you were speaking, something came up in my mind. I was remembering an article I read, and I can't remember the details, but some smart people with a big computer figured out that every breath we take contains molecules from Julius Caesar's breath, you know, and something like that. I mean, just wow, what, you know? And so all this magic we talk about is so connected into reality that it is reality, and we just don't see it because we haven't quite turned our minds in a certain way to see it, like a prism, you know. Sort of to discount it because it doesn't sound logical, or, you know, just it's a shame. It's hard because I get up and I stand up and I expect the floor to be there when I stand up. But, you know.
There's a place for consensual reality.
Right. Yeah.
But the miracle of the floor
being
there, and not just the floor being there, but also the capacity of my feet to feel, the proprioceptive, that me and the floor are in this intimate relationship that is so hard to see because we rely on it. And I think to, you know, this ordinary miracle of walking in step with each other, each step.
It's mostly empty space, actually.
That's right.
You know? Yes. It's the floor when you consider the distance between the molecules.
And it's in motion.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at it with an electron microscope, it's not solid floor.
Yeah, it's
a symbol
of the kind.
Yeah, it is.
Right.
And it's Dharmakaya, it's empty.
Yeah.
And our foot meets it. It's Nirmanakaya, too.
So there's still something here that bothers me, though. I mean, kind of along the lines of what Todd was saying, because that was, he described kind of the progression there that I went through from the first time that we read this. I just went, wow. I mean, I'm really glad they gave me a list of which instruments I had to play, you know. A mandolin is okay, but a guitar is not acceptable, sorry. So, I mean, there's something very important about I think, for me anyway, this like a devotional, you know, quality of it's really important that I be able to call out in pain if I'm in pain, or to in celebration when I'm joyful, you know, and both are true. But this, the word that really bothers me is this distracted thing. You know, and I love what David said about, you know, if half-heartedly, you know, if that's all you can muster, then half-hearted is fine, right? And so you could say, well, okay, so then, you know, distracted maybe is okay too. But what comes up for me as we were talking about this, I was thinking of our pre-ceremony where we keep saying with sincere mind and body, or sincere heart, or something along those lines, and you know, I bow to the Buddha, I bow to this, I bow to, and this, you know, this heart of sincerity and intentionality seems, you know, so important in this devotional thing anyway, and the alternative that comes. So my mother had this friend who was a Catholic priest, right? And he was a great guy and funny and somebody asked him, you know, a question about religion. And he said, oh, I don't know anything about that. I'm not very religious. That's just my job. You know, I happen to be a priest and I do these rituals, you know, but I'm not religious. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that really bothers me, you know, is that, you know, religion, it seems to me, can easily fall into that trap of going through the motions, mm-hmm. you know. And this would appear to be saying that it's enough to go through the motions, right? That it doesn't actually matter whether you mean it or not. It's okay just to do this particular list of things is enough.
Slightly move your head.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I can see that slight is okay because maybe all you can do is slight. Yeah. You know, if you know if that's the best you can do, right? Then slight's okay, right? But still, you ought to mean it, right? I don't know. It shouldn't just be an empty ritual.
Well, I think in the world of form, in the world of right and wrong, there's empty ritual and there's profound devoted ritual. But in this world that this sutra is presenting, everything is already the awakened part, so it doesn't make any difference. You know, and that I think that's a doorway to freedom for people who are trying so hard to be devoted. And also, the other part of this is, we think we know what it means to be devoted or to try hard or to be... But we don't know. We don't know what that is. How can we know that? So, yeah. I think you could read it the way you're reading it. I think that would be a way to read it. I'm not reading it that way myself. I'm seeing it as a relief. Because if I'm going up to the altar and bowing and lighting the candle and suddenly a thought occurs to me, oh, today's trash day, that doesn't diminish
right.
what I'm doing.
Right.
Right? In fact, it might enhance it because it might get the trash out on time.
Right. But if you do it like, okay, so every day I have to do this thing, right? Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, just part of my being, whatever, you know, being a priest, there's this list of things I need to do every day, mm-hmm. right? And I just do them.
Well, but what if we get to experiment and see which way is most fun? Right? There's some way this is disturbing, I think, in quite a lovely way. Because we can rely on our earnestness. And fine to be earnest, and maybe I enjoy bringing body and mind when I bow and totally bowing, but we can fetishize anything, right? And then I'm worshiping my wholeheartedness, right? As opposed to this mystery. Mm-hmm. What if it's all happening in this mystery? And we get to see. So sometimes we really are called to work so hard and to pour every effort into just this. But we don't have to fulfill some idea. Well, I've made up this idea that if I, you know. So I think it for me, the possibility is we get to do what we want. And if you want to bow half-heartedly, I totally know some days half-heartedly is probably more than I have.
Right.
You know, if I was up to 25%, and that those days I may still be acceptable.
Oh.
Right? Those days maybe I don't have to beat myself up, but fully blessed, fully the full thing.
Well, yeah, and this is, I think this is part of the teaching is as profound as the not knowing that the 25% is 100%. You know, that you there isn't, that we don't cut the world down like that. I mean, we do with our minds, but we don't need to do it. The universe isn't made of partial things. It's this whole thing. Mm.
And this is the 1% is 100%.
Right. 1%
right.
Is
right. Even 1%.
A slight nod is a, yeah. Right. I love that, moving the head a
little. Even if you don't mean it.
Everybody do that.
All right, complete. Let's go home. All right, go.
Well, actually, that's very related. That story of the guy who was told if he hit his head with a ball 30 times, he would be awakened. You know, like, it's a totally wrong idea. You know, it's just off in so many ways, and yet.
When I worked in schools, and a teacher would have a student who was just pushing them over the edge, I would say, he's trying his best. Mm-hmm. There is not a child in the world who isn't trying his best.
Yeah.
And yet, for some reason, with adults, or myself, or what. Mm. That's how the, you know, like, mm-hmm. I applied that to kids.
Yeah.
Not to the universe as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Or you.
Or you.
Or yourself.
Yeah.
I had a boss once who, I remember I would go to him and say, I'm trying my best. And he would say, that's not enough. I don't believe in that crap. And I think that is a pervasive view in the world. This is a different, you know, that when you really look at all the causes and conditions, then you see that everybody's just doing what they can do. That's a different view than this. No, you could try harder. Yeah.
Well, and
on the other hand,
right? Trying my best, and I vow to save all beings.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Not enough yet, and fully complete.
Yeah, right. We can't land on either side.
And I'll still struggle with that text.
Good.
Oh yeah, good. Right. Excellent. Yeah. Wonderful. May it be so for all of us forever.
Amen.
Amen. And now we'll turn to page 23 in our hymnal.